Srđa Popović is a Serbian political activist who was one of the founders of Otpor, a student group that helped topple the dictator Milosevic, and whose current group, Canvas, teaches activists around the world how to overthrow their authoritarian governments. This is Srđa Popović. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right. I am here with Srđa Popović. Sir, thank you very much for joining me today.
Pleasure being with you, Duncan.
So you are someone who you have your hands in a lot of different pots. You are known for being a worldwide instigator, if I may use the word, or aider and abettor of revolutions around the world, toppling dictators. You give blueprints for this kind of work. This is all very heavy stuff. How did you get started doing this?
Well, first of all, it's a little bit too overreaction to say that that you can somehow get help to get rid of a dictator. But I got involved as an activist in my student days, and I thought about playing in the rock band and getting all the dates. But then we got this nasty guy called Slobodan Milošević, and then my generation found itself between two choices, to fight or to flee. And guess I was among those stubborn ones that decided to fight. So we were involved in activism since students' protest for peace in 1992 against the nationalist war of Slobodan Milošević. And then after fraudulent elections, 96, 97, together with some other people, I was leading this protest. In 98, when the opposition fell apart and the last wave of ethnic cleansing was started in Kosovo, after that, the war with NATO, we had a very turbulent history under this guy. We decided to form the movement called Otpor, which is the Serbian word for resistance. And we grew from 11 people to maybe 20, 25,000 within the year. And our goal was to bring young people to activism, young people to vote, which kind of materialized in an opposition victory in 2000, where unprecedented number of young people voted. And also the organization was very instrumental in defending that vote, because what dictators do when they lose elections, they repeat it till they win it. But we didn't let this guy do that. After the Serbian nonviolent revolution in 2000, I went for 3 years in government and a parliament, and these were not the three most thrilling years of my life, but I was passionate to try to change the beast from the inside, if you want.
Yes.
Since 2002, 2003, we started being contacted by the groups across the globe. They were inspired by a Serbian nonviolent movement and wanted to share some thoughts and knowledge. And this is how we started Canvas, Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies, the organization I'm running ever since, whose goal is to produce toolboxes and equip activists across the globe in more effective way to fight for global change, as well as cooperating with universities, including some prominent in US. I am teaching Colorado College as we speak. I teach University of Essex near London as well. This knowledge of what the movements really are, what lies behind the successful nonviolent movements, and can you somehow predict whether the movement would be successful or not? All of this and more has been my life in the last 20 years, and I must say that I enjoyed working with some of the bravest game changers across the planet.
Okay, so that was a very concise description of how you came about into this line of work. But I want to back up just a little bit, because your group, Otpor, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, imagine when you first started off, when, you know, you're living in an authoritarian country, there are severe punishments for going against the regime. How did you guys even get together in the first place?
Oh, well, you know, when you see young people and students on the brink of many changes across the globe, just because the fact that when you're a student, you have more courage, you have more stamina, you are more in a James Dean mode, and you also have less to lose. So it's far more difficult to suppress somebody who doesn't have to lose a lot outside of his or her crazy head. And I think that was the reason why, on the brink of many changes across the globe, you see young people, students, unemployed people. And basically in Serbia, it was a matter of choice. You could decide to go with the flow and escape the country. The economy was terrible. The nationalism was painful. The wars were terrifying. And also we lost all of them. So instead of going with the flow, you can decide to take a risk. And Milosevic was kind of a benevolent dictator turning into more harsh dictator at the late 90s. So yes, you would get under surveillance. Yes, you would get all the nasty titles in the state media. Yes, you will be labeled as an enemy of state and terrorist, foreign mercenary, whatever, drug dealer. And worst case scenario, they would arrest you. And they arrested 2,400 people throughout the movement space. Not all of them were treated the same. Some of them were arrested and beaten and sentenced. I was arrested and beaten, but not sentenced. And then the others were kind of the released. Our idea in this was to make this cool. And it may sound crazy, but if you look at some contemporary groups who make arrests looking cool, like Extinction Rebellion, it's a very intelligent tactics. The more you spread the nonviolent struggle, the more you spread numbers, the more people you mobilize to bend the rules, the more oppression becomes ineffective. The role of oppression, the role of any kind of the state sanctions against dissent is to prevent further dissent. So you get punished, but others get the idea what will happen to them. If you have many people disobeying the law, and if you have many people standing against the dictator, and then the dictator is faced with a very harsh dilemma, whether to expand oppression and make more people pissed off, or let people do what they do despite the ban and thus lose the authority. Our idea was to, with small, witty, and generally legal actions, to provoke as many arrests as possible to make this oppression backfire. And it worked. It worked great. And people who has been arrested in Otpor or beaten in Otpor or arrested more than once, and there are many like that, were wearing dates of their arrests as a medal of honor, and others wanted to be like them. So create a kind of the reverse mentality of rebellion within the organization and within the constituency, and that really helps making oppression backfire.
And one of the things that, I mean, you just mentioned the James Dean attitude, you said earlier, rock and roll, and you guys, you did use a lot of humor in your protests, your activism. And I think you said before something like the more fun the movement is, the more likely it's going to be successful. How did you arrive at that conclusion?
Well, first of all, Serbs are funny people, and Serbs don't take themselves for serious, neither do take others for serious. And humor is a part of our mentality. But more important, we throughout the 1992, the first UN demonstrations, then 1996, we were trying many things, from angry protests, large marches, physical blockades of the building, all the way to the very extreme tactics like mass hunger strikes. And we figured out that if you deal with a gray bureaucrat who doesn't have a sense of humor, every time you poke this person, he will respond violently. And that makes him a bully and makes you look cool. And the role of humor in nonviolent struggle is my eternal passion since then. And we've done the very big research as the organization, as well as teaming up with some experts like Sophia McLennan. And actually, a few months ago, we came up with a book called Pranksters versus Autocrats that you can buy for £3 on Amazon. And the idea of the book is taking a look at why humor is so effective, why putting your opponent in a dilemma works every time, regardless of the situation, why humor affects these movements, and how can you make a data out of it. So we're looking at whether the membership would grow if you use humor, whether the narrative would change if you use humor, whether your opponent will look stupid if you lose humor, whether there's an outsized media reaction, whether the action would be replicated. So we put all of the scientific binaries into the mix and came to a amazing conclusion. Basically, to dissect a long academic story short, humor works great because of the three reasons. First, when you put your opponent in a dilemma and use humor, your opponent has to react. And there is a price tag if he or she does react, especially like, you know, it's like you bring out the big petrol barrel, put the face of the president on it, make people beat it with a bat and put the coins in, and then the police comes. And they need to stop this, because if they don't, it will be replicated. And they don't know how to stop it, because the best thing they can do, they can arrest people who don't break any law, but just hitting the barrel. So they're faced with a dilemma, which they solved very often in the most stupid way. In Serbia, they arrested the barrel. In Russia, Putin banned the toy protests. So you put your opponent between the rock, being stupid, and the hard place, being weak. And this is one of the three reasons why humor work. Other two has nothing to do with social movements, but with our own psychology. First, humor is the best antidote for fear and apathy. And if you need to go or prepare yourself for a surgery, the last thing you want to know is what the surgeon is going to do to you. The best thing that can happen to you is your friend and cracking a joke, because joke sounds fear, makes it go away. Same work with apathy, which is the major reason why some countries have status quo. I'm talking about the kind of apathetic democracies. And if you take a look at the apathy and take a look at the party that you're forced to go, immediately few people with great sense of humor come in and start poking jokes, and somebody puts on the costume and start entertaining everybody, and immediately you don't want to go. So humor is a great antidote for fear and apathy, and humor puts your opponent between the rock and the hard place. And last but not least importance, the humor is cool. And the movements who appear to be cool are more likely to mobilize more people, because people love things that are cool. People love joining cool things, and people love being around cool people. And if you take a look at your phone book in your phone and ask seriously yourself, who is the person I most love to be around? It's normally not the most educated, smartest, richest, or best-looking person. It's the person who can always make you laugh. So because it's cool, because it puts your opponent between the rock and the hard place, and because it's a great antidote for apathy and fear, depending on where you are performing your struggle, the humor is a great addition to any nonviolent movement anywhere in the world.
Well, let me ask you something about that then, because figures like in our country, Trump or Duterte in the Philippines, oftentimes they use humor, and you know, whether people like it or not, it does get crowds laughing. And it feels like a lot of the times on areas that might be called like the natural left, or people who would oppose these authoritarian figures, there doesn't seem to be a lot of a lot of times going in those spaces, it feels almost humorless. Do you pick up on that at all? Or what are your thoughts on that phenomenon?
Well, first of all, the phenomenon we are looking at is not simply humor. It's something we call laughtivism. And laughtivism is a strategic combination of creating a tactic that creates dilemma, for example, petrol barrel or the toy protests. And, or you know, it's like you are speaking about the U.S., we recently had amazing cases of laughtivism. We have the group called Indivisible in US, which wants to talk about healthcare with their opposing senators and congressmen. And then they don't appear on a town hall. And next thing you know, the groups are organizing town halls, and they either speak to the empty suits, which represent their missing senator, or the congressman. And you can see billboards everywhere, Senator XYZ escaped, missed in action. If you see him or her, call 1-800 whatever. Looking at how this creates a dilemma for the opponent, and that's just not just mocking. Mocking is very different, and satire is generally very different from the laughtivism, because satire, the satire increases your understanding of the world and makes you wittier and smarter and less vulnerable to the fake news. This is one of the researches my partner, Sophia McLennan, is taking on. The people who watch Saturday Night Live show are less susceptible to the conspiracy theories, for example. But more important, you find sometimes humorless or no, I wouldn't really draw the lines between the ideologies, but basically what you want to see is to for people to understand that if you're angry, yes, you can mobilize people on that emotion, but anger without hope and lightheadedness and people feeling good, participating in a thing, will not last long or can provoke very angry or uncontrolled behavior from people. Things like throwing stones and destroying the property. So if you look at what you really want as a fuel in your engine of mobilization, it's far better if this fuel is positive and it relates to the humor and hope, rather than it is just based on anger and the fact, oh, I don't like this guy in power, we need to do something about it.
And you also mentioned just a little bit ago the fact that you went into parliament for a bit. What was that like coming from an activist background? And part of the reason why I ask is because there are a lot of activist movements like Occupy Wall Street, where they have all this energy, but in terms of where they want to go after the quote unquote revolution is achieved, sometimes it's less clear. So when you got into government, did you all have a specific vision of where you wanted to take it?
Well, I mean, I can speak from a personal perspective, which of course is very subjective. My idea was if I run to change the system and not just the president, then I need to do something about the system, not just the president. And yes, president concede the elections. And yes, president is extradited to be trialed for war crimes in Hague. But that doesn't mean that the system is changed. And I wanted to see the system from the inside. I was a political animal since my mid-20s. I was elected to the local municipality. I've been a member of the city municipality and ended up being in the parliament. My passion, my private passion, is environment. I'm a biologist by education. I'm a big fan of outdoors and fishing. And my biggest shame is that I belong to the nation that throw garbage through the windows and has a very dirty streets and doesn't really care about the rivers and breathes very bad air and doesn't to be in aware of the fact that it will be our kids to pay the price for our behavior. So I had a very small, rather selfish idea that throughout my work in the parliament through the 3 years, and I was a vice chair of the environmental committee, I can work on laws and regulations, and that was most of my work in the parliament was related to the things like forestry and fisheries and environmental system and protection and restrictions and regulations for factories and things that may be boring and very technical if you take a look at them, but were a very important part of what I was thinking. So that was my case. The second question is, however, what happens if the movement doesn't have the plan for day after? And this is a very interesting question in our university work, and also with our work with activists. You want to take a look at the case studies where people succeeded, but you also want to take a look at the case studies where people failed. So how come that the Zimbabweans keep trying and failing with their corrupt government? How come that after the bliss that was internationally called the Arab Spring, Arab Revolution, we have far more dire situations in places like Egypt and Libya and Syria? And the answer is, it is easier to mobilize the people to get large numbers and make your opponent concede than to maintain these people in an institutional type of change. And that also comes with a strategy that people don't have. And very often people look only to the point, once again, it's sparked by anger and discontent. We need to get this guy go. And then what? Then what happens next 7 days, next 3 weeks, next 100 days? So taking a look at the science, and there are many, many scientists looking at this case, and Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stefan are just the most prominent one in the field. You theoretically have more chances to mobilize millions and, for example, make dictators step down than to maintain this change over the course of the 5 years. And this sounds bizarre, that it is easier to mobilize million people than to maintain a change. But this is what it is, because these changes, in order to become real, need to become institutional. And they need to go through the pillars or the institutions of system. And you need to change the system, and you need to change it forever. And very often, people get a small victory, people get cosmetic change, and then they lose the steam, or they proclaim this victory, and they don't see behind this change, which is some of these struggles are the long marathons. The you want to speak about the women's rights. And yes, I mean, there you have election next week in US and probably more women will vote than men. And you get more women in the House and the Senate than ever. And you may even get the female vice president if the Democrats win the elections. But when you take a look at how much women are paid compared to the men for the same job, it's still 70%. So you still have this gender gap in many aspects of life, not to mention the racial gap. Yes, BLM movement may be very effective in raising awareness about the stuff. And yes, once again, you may have less violence of the police against the people of color. But when you take a look at the neighborhoods they live, and when you take a look at the schools they attend, when you take a look at the jobs they get, when you take a look at the pay gap, this is where the racism still thrives. So you need to take a look at the systemic change. You need to be patient and you need to build your change pillar by pillar, victory by victory. And very often people get tired. People get sucked in their lives. People get sucked in their job. But basically to cut a long story short, one of the most important reasons why movements fail is not that they are not able to provide the numbers, is not that they are not able to provide the energy that will beat apathy and fear. It's not because their opponent is violent and will kill them all. It's because that when they win, they don't finish what they started.
That I think that is so important to say, and I kind of want to touch on that a little bit more, just because the when you were in Serbia and you started off with your student group of 12 people, and that gets built up over the course of time into, you know, tens of thousands and eventually helps topple a dictator. Just the fact that all these interactions are occurring largely in person, you're not mediated by, you know, Facebook or Twitter, where it's very easy to, you know, send a tweet or, you know, take a picture of yourself at a protest and then go home. Movements like Occupy, like the Arab Spring, or even like BLM now, a lot of people are driven out onto the streets through social media activism. And as you said, a lot of the times you have all this enormous energy and opportunity and it sort of dissipates. Do you think on any level that the internet, despite having made it easier in many ways for people to come together and to get those millions out onto the street, do you think it has made it harder to form those lasting social bonds that might deliver a real formative movement?
I think you're very right, Duncan. Like any new technology, the social media and internet and virtual world, and if you want it, and that also involves the cryptocurrency and some other phenomena. It's a two-bladed sword. So yes, like the nuclear energy, you can use it for heating homes and hospitals and incubators for little babies, but you can also put it in a very handy bomb and then you throw it on Hiroshima. So depending on how you use the thing and depending on who is using the thing, every new technology comes with both sides. On the good side of how the new technology is changing nonviolent struggles, you have several. First, you just mentioned it, it's easier to assemble people. 20 years ago, you want to organize a political rally. You need to go door to door, you need to call phones, you need to spread leaflets, posters, gather arrested, spend time, and then the people will know and they will appear. Now you make a hashtag or a Facebook group and everybody knows. Second thing, you can document things. We are living in the era of citizen journalism, and more and more it's pretty obvious that however you restrict the internet, and there are attempts recently in Zimbabwe and Sudan, and we are looking at it at Hong Kong. And several weeks ago, Belarus dictator who was on the knees after stealing elections, actually started banning communicators over social media. Only Telegram is live there. And the thing is, however you suppress it, the world would get learn. And as you had a Sudanese situation last February, you had a large movement, you have a military during the coup, you have the movement who wanted military to cede power to civilians and not stealing the revolution like in Egypt. And then you had a brutal crackdown with hundreds of dead people. And of course, the internet blacked down for a few weeks. Immediately, you see celebrities like Shakira having videos from Sudan, posting support from Sudan, like, you know, because all you need is a cell phone and there is an easy way to share the videos, even if the internet is restricted. So other reason why internet is great is because it's very difficult to put a thing under the rug and really close countries. I think that the era of North Korea type of states is over. Lastly, but not least importance, internet enables learning. I'm teaching my class in CC over Zoom. We probably did 20, 30, 40, I don't know how many Zoom sessions this year with activists across the world, educating them and training them because of travel restrictions and COVID, but also because it's safer for them not to travel outside of their authoritarian countries and meet troublemakers like us. And people can learn faster. People can share this knowledge horizontally. You have somebody do something really effective in a place A, somebody else take it from there. Look at the Fridays for Future. Look at the Extinction Rebellion. Look at the movement that owned their worldwide spread to the fact that people have seen this on the net and tried this at home. Without real guidance, without a pyramidal structure, without somebody to instruct them. So there is a lot of this peer-to-peer learning, which is kind of great. Last but not least importance, we have more and more tools to equip people with material resources where material resources are strained. And one of the first nerve of the autocrats is putting more restrictions on how their opponents from civil sector can be funded. And where this is labeling them as foreign agents, like in Russia, or controlling their bank accounts and, you know, investigating them. But now we are in the era of the Bitcoin. Now you can use Bitcoin to safely donate and safely get money to the places that are where the normal flow of money is restricted. You have a BLM case was great. You had the YouTubers, the top influencers from California, that were having zillions of views on their profiles and earning a bunch of money in the commercials. And what they did, they made the specific messages in support to the racial equality. They taped their videos with these messages. They invite millions of their followers to watch. And with the money got from these views, they were supporting Black Lives Matter movement. So all of this and more is there at the movement's disposal. On the other hand, internet makes you disconnected. Internet gives you the false idea that you did something only because you liked or shared the page, which is the thing we call slacktivism. And I need to disappoint you. I don't know how many pages about saving the planet or the polar bears you clicked, but you didn't actually save the planet. If you turn your computer off and your light off and your car off, you're actually doing something for the planet. And other thing is the bad guys are using it. There's this great book by Peter Pomerantsev of how actually we are living in a post-truth world and how truth was assassinated by spreading the fake news and trolling by those who don't love the fact that, you know, so many scientists said that planet is going to hell. And they would really like to say this is a Chinese hoax. So let's kill the science. Let's kill the truth. And we are living in the era where there is no, the world becomes more tribal. And the more you live in these echo chamber rooms, the more you believe only your sources. And it's very difficult to define or claim that something is truth, even if this comes from an experienced, long tradition, powerful media. You can always label them as a fake news. So this is second reason why it's very, very dangerous. Together with surveillance and the fact that the companies and governments can get all the data from you. If you want to get spooked, go on Netflix, watch Social Dilemma. It's a great one hour and 20 minute documentary about how the social media changed our world. When you watch it, you decide whether it's changed for better. And last but not least importance, the real trouble with this, it gives people the idea that they have to occupy Because, you know, it's like when you take a look at the Arab Spring and then have a look at the Occupy Wall Street, and because people see so many people occupying symbolic public place, this is the first tactic they use. And this is called Occupyism, right? Call it Occupyism. And the funky thing about the Occupyism is the fact that this is actually a very risky tactic. When you work with movements, you kind of advise them to use this type of tactics only when they have numbers and organization and resources to really maintain it. The tactics of concentration, especially the tactics of concentration combined with occupation and blockades, are very likely to provoke your opponent's violent response. They're very likely to be divisive because you're blocking something that other people may want to use, whether this is a building or a street. And they're also very difficult to maintain because, you know, it's like, what happens if the government ignores you? And that happened in Hong Kong in the last wave of protests. The people occupied the whole city for weeks. And mainland China just decided they're going to ignore them till their numbers dwindle. And I mean, only because you see it on the internet, think twice before you occupy the place. So yes, agree. It was a very long answer. The new media added some amazing features to the nonviolent struggle, but the new media also enabled opponents to learn faster, to survey better, to organize the troll farms, to assassinate the true, and gives you the false idea of where the change really happens. And the change really happens in the real world, not in the virtual world.
I'm glad you gave a long answer, because there are a number of things in there I want to talk about. But among them, when you mentioned Occupy, did you ever meet with any of the leaders of Occupy while it was going on?
I randomly met some of the leaders of Occupy by absolute chance. I was teaching on NYU in November 2011, and then I ended up being hooked up with a group from Zuccotti Park through the professor I know, who is a well prominent historic lefty guy from Colombia, and I spent like 2 hours with them trying to figure out what the situation is. And as I noted in my book, Blueprint for Revolution, I came out super depressed. Because, I mean, it's like with not even pretending to be neutral, I'm the guy standing for social justice. I'm the guy who is among 99%. I'm the guy who think that greedy banks can change their policies. So, I mean, it's not whether my heart was on their side or not. It was because we spent 2.5 hours with me playing a devil's lawyer and asking questions, okay, what do you really want? And them telling me that having a strategy is a corporate thing, without even thinking that the strategy is a Greek world, which originates for some seven centuries before Christ, and probably 15 or 20 centuries before the corporations.
Sorry to interrupt. They literally said to you, oh, having a strategy, that's corporate?
Yeah, but no, they were like, say, so you must be, you look to the movements from the very corporate perspective, because you tell us that we need to have a vision and a strategy and the plans and within plans. And then we need, it's like you're kind of thinking of incorporating the movement while we need to be this large chunk of equals that vote every day about everything. And we need total consensus about everything. I'm caricating this. This is not really how the discussion go. But basically the thing is like, I think they failed in building the backbone of the protests. And if you take a look at the successful movements, the first principle is you need to have unity and vision. So vision needs to be there. And then you play devil's lawyer. It's like, okay, you are against the greedy banks. So here is the rubber. I'm the Harry Potter. I erase all the bank like today, what's there? So let's say we win and there are no more banks. We closed up Wells Fargo tomorrow morning, and then the Citibank Tuesday, and then whatever, Deutsche Bank, and then the World Bank next weekend. So there are zero banks. And, you know, how do you buy coffee? Because there is no banks. So you need to have a kind of alternative vision of the reality. And you can't really win by being against. And this goes back to the idea of the anger and hope and small victories. And other thing was also name brand. I think when you label the movement around one single tactic, you are actually disfranchising a lot of people. Because I may, as I support these goals strongly, but I have job and a half and two small kids and absolutely no time in my day to sit in a park. So how do I fit in the movement? What about labeling themselves 99%? This would probably bring more people to identify with them. So how you brand movement, how you label the movement is almost equally important as how you structure the values and how we formulate the vision. And I think these were the, when we look at the failed cases, and we often use Occupy as a case on failed cases, this is like they made three classic mistakes. First one, no vision. The second one, sticking to one tactic and a very risky and complicated tactic. And the third one was wrong targeting. And I mean that when you really want to win in nonviolent struggle, targeting is quintessential. And people very often don't understand this. And people very often think that going and shouting on the street is what a nonviolent struggle is. And then you piss them off. My question to them was like, okay, here, but because we met really close to Tsukote Park, this wonderful square, I think it's called Washington Square, in one of the buildings of NYU, near NYU. And I said, it's like, okay, here is the Wall Street, and here is the Tsukote Park, and here you are sitting in this park. And here are the stock exchange brokers, and these are their gyms. And this is where they go to gyms after they do their trade to relax. And they have this big glass windows because they're very fancy gyms for rich people. And through these windows, they see you and they have a lot of fun. How in the world do you think you're disrupting the banking system by sitting in a park? And they kind of backed off and said, okay, how many of you in this room get business reply mail? And maybe 18 out of 20 people raise hands. So this is what you get from your bank. You want a new loan, you want a new car insurance. You want, it's like, this is what your enemy is giving you the chance to act. They say, what about putting 99% on a brick? Putting the brick into business reply mail and mailing brick with a message of 99% back to the bank. And this costs bank $17. Imagine 100,000 people doing this. Now we are talking. Now you're hitting your own. So understanding that targeting is important, and you want to take a look at the Montgomery bus boycott in the US, the famous thing, all about this fairy tale of Rosa Parks bravely standing and not conceding to the segregation. But never ask yourself a question, why Montgomery and why buses? Okay, why Montgomery? Because this is the place where protesting in front of the city hall will get civil rights activists nothing. Because the officials who were segregating things were elected by a white minority who was super happy with segregated toilets. And they wouldn't care about the black vote because it's small percents. But the businesses that were driving people to work were very susceptible to this type of tactic because majority of their consumers were Afro-Americans. The white people had cars. So now we are talking about the targeting. If A doesn't work, which is the legislative, you target B, which is the business. And you end up the white-owned businesses whose money got white segregationist politicians elected in American South during civil rights movement, running to their mayors and governors and say, you need to end up the segregation laws because we will go bankrupt. And then you will go bankrupt. So now you're looking at where clever targeting can bring you, and now you can distinguish between targeting the bank by sending it back a brick in a business reply mail versus sitting in a park in front of the bank.
When you suggested the brick thing, because I love that idea, there was, I don't know if you heard, but there was some comedian, Doug Stanhope, who talked about, you know, don't sit in a park, you know, walk up dressed in a suit and say, you know, I need to apply for a billion-dollar bank loan for an ant farm, you know, sharpen your pencils. So something to actually obstruct. But did you suggest that to them directly, and did they have any reaction?
Oh, it was not a suggestion. It was a case study. This is what was done by the labor movement activists back there in the 60s and 70s in the United States. So this is not something that I came out from my wizard's bag. This is a live case study. The funky thing about these movements is that they, I mean, look at the BLM. Once again, we have this tremendous opportunity now. The world is so mobilized about this big problem of the racial injustice. And because I'm in US, I have this marvelous opportunity. I live in a small town called Colorado Springs now, and I teach a class with a very open-minded professor on CC. So what two of us have done, we invited some local activist groups in the class, and among them is the group that is leading the BLM idea here in Colorado Springs. And they're very bright people, very energetic people, people from all walks of life, people of all three races that live in well, maybe a little bit like I've seen people of all walks of life there. So it's very inclusive. Right. It's very diverse. It's not just, you know, angry black people. This is very good start. And when we speak with these people, they did some tremendous work in public awareness rising, and they do some tremendous work in talking with the city hall and expanding this to the Colorado as a state, which is a very liberal state, unlike Colorado Springs, which is a kind of the conservative town. And then you start playing the devil's lawyer. It's okay, let's defund the police and let's put a camera on each police person and let's make sure that everybody gets what they deserve when they mistreat people of color. And then you go to school, and then I go to school, and then you go to bad school, and then I go to good school because I'm white. And then we get a job, and then we get a salary for that job. And then I get a bigger salary than you for the same job, of course, because I'm white. So now you're looking at so many different tentacles of this problem and expanding the strategy to many pillars, and especially like talking about the salary and the businesses and opportunities in a place like America. You never had businesses being so open to embrace that. They don't know what to do to embrace these things because it's so predominant that even the smallest comment, regardless to be dismissive or racist, will cost brands millions of dollars. So they need, this public awareness rising succeeded in making big companies and brands open to the idea of the racial equality. And how do you turn this into the norm? How do you make companies report on how much they pay people of color and how much they pay people of white color? I mean, these are the things where you have a marvelous opportunity that shouldn't be missed. And once again, it's Wall Street, it's banks. You look at only one segment of the system you want to change, where the comprehensive strategy should be looking at multiple pillars and deciding to act towards the pillars that can be switched fastest and with largest impact. This is what a lot of lefties would find very corporate type of thinking, but this is not corporate type of thinking. This is strategic type of thinking that movements need to adopt in order to succeed.
But the question is, how do you get movements to work in that way? Like when you mentioned Occupy and people would have a vote on every agenda item, and the entire crowd of people had to show up and vote and arrive at a consensus. That is democracy in its purest form, and that's in large part what Occupy was fighting for. But at the same time, it's very slow moving. And it can lead to a lot of disagreements and make the movement in some ways weaker. In your case, in Serbia, you were, among others, a leader within that movement. And I imagine you had a good say in shaping the direction of that movement and providing strategy and so on. But how do you take a movement of millions of people and develop a strategy and remain democratic and inclusive and arriving at a consensus and so on?
I think this is a good question. And of course, every single movement, whereby scaling or its topic or the mentality of the people, needs to invent their own way of the organization. So it's not something that you can copy paste and say, okay, this is how movement was organized in Serbia. This is how every single movement in the world should be organized. That would be a mistake. What you need to figure out when you are building your movement is first understand the importance of organization and understand that building organization during the large waves of mobilization is what makes movements survive once this mobilization wanes. And it will wane because mobilization is like sea. It comes in waves. Second, understanding the importance of numbers. The more people you have in the movement, the more likely you are to succeed. And then utilizing these numbers in terms of structure is somewhere where movements need to figure it out. Some love more vertical structures. Some movements are blessed with a charismatic leaders like Mohandas Gandhi. Some movements love to be decentralized or need to be decentralized. So the movement was very centralized in terms of strategy. The strategy was out very early. The general plan was there very early. The targeted pillars were there very early while we were a relatively small group of people. And then the others accepted that. But on the local level, people were running their own show and giving people a lot of autonomy in their ideas and how to bring these ideas out doesn't necessarily mean that we need to vote 70 times about the same thing. So this is like needing to get 100% consensus about everything. Yes, some may call it democracy, but this is. I mean, we have very different ideas then about what democracy is. And there is a very ingenious Serbian leader who was my political mentor and later become the first democratically elected prime minister of Serbia, Zoran Djindjic. He probably stole this quote, but I quote it as his because I heard it from him. He says, democracy is great for making a decision. Democracy in executing decision leads to anarchy. So once we decide that we need to go against this pillar, once we decide about our general strategy is nonviolence, once we decide about how we are going to distinguish in our tactics, and once we decide which tactic we are going to be involved, we are not voting about this every day. So this is where you need to make a balance between the efficiency of the organization and democracy within the organization. And there is no universal model on how to do it, but efficiency and democracy are both things that need to be taken into account when you are selecting the type of your organization, the verticality versus horizontality, the role of central versus decentral leadership, and especially in a large scale organizations, the large scale countries or large scale issues like environment, where you have movements that are stretching from Australia to Alaska. And of course, it's very difficult to centralize all this kind of stuff. So the organization model is one thing, but the principles 1, 2, 3 are, once again, you need numbers and you need to recruit often, train people and keep them active. Number two, the organization follows these mobilization waves and need to maintain a long-term structure. And C, you may want to have a centralized leadership or decentralized leadership, but you need to have leadership, because thousands and millions of people need to be led, and that requires a certain amount of leadership.
And one of the things...
And I can ask one short question, because I will start next interview in 10 minutes.
Sure, yes. In that case...
And it's Mother Jones. I can poke them and say, oh, I just spoke to guy that you left this...
yeah. The one thing you mentioned in there, Peter Pomerantsev, I might be mispronouncing his name, but I've read a couple of his books, and one of them you were featured in. I think it was like, This Is Not Propaganda.
Uh-huh.
But he talks about the fact that in many ways, authoritarian governments like the Kremlin now have adopted some of your tactics of like using wacky hijinks or... You spoke about how at one point you put a bunch of stickers around Belgrade, and that gives, you know, a power to the movement because you see a sign of resistance everywhere. Well, now authoritarian governments are flooding message boards with their own pro-regime messages, and that gives the regime a form of power. Do you think that your techniques have been co-opted in any way by authoritarian regimes? And how do you deal with that?
The bad guys learn as well as the good guys. And I think it's a learning curve on both sides. And when it comes to social media, they actually learn faster. And they are far more ahead when it comes to abusing the digital world. I wouldn't agree that they are so much ahead when it comes to the physical world, because this is where the creativity and the community plays the major role. This is not something that can be invented in. I mean, the clown pranks are different when they're exercised by people from your neighborhood and when they're exercised by the government officials. And they have a very different appeal depending on who is doing this. But yes, they learn, and there is a whole book about this called Dictator's Learning Curve, written by another good friend of mine, Will Dobson. And you see how they're learning to contain the protests before they behave. You see how they're learning to cripple these organizations financially and in front of propaganda. You see when they're learning when it comes to the narratives and tactics. And it's a learning curve. Which is, I think, the only solution is what we are trying on a very small pioneering level, is making these tools of social change accessible to the people everywhere, free of charge, which is training millions of people in how to achieve social change strategically, and which is making the social change and fighting the fake news and equality the part of the school curriculum, because this is where you learn stuff. And I mean, the yes, you can cry foul that, you know, the climate change is a Chinese hoax, and you can mimic any campaign or any tactic from our toolbox in order to prove it. But still, new generations that are coming are more aware of the climate change than our generation or the generation of our parents. Why so? Because they received it through the education. So when you take a look at how you win ultimately, not tactically, they do this tactic, then you use this tactic, then they adopt this. That's a very tactical level. But strategically speaking, the struggle for people empowerment between the authoritarians and the people who lean more towards the progressive ideas and democracy lies in the fact that authoritarians want to preserve status quo where people are sheep. And your job, if you're against it, is to build a toolbox and enable people knowledge, how to educate themselves and how to act effectively in order to prove that they're not a sheep.
Sergio, on that note, I'm going to let you go and do your other interview. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Duncan. Looking forward. Once it's online, just send it to me. We can also share it through our social media.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Pleasure speaking to you, my friend.
All right.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. Thank you to Sergio Popovich, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.